This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
2 weeks ago, the regional government of Wallonia in Belgium voted to reject CETA, or the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement. Canadian and European trade representatives had spent the last 7 years negotiating this agreement, and after an additional week of negotiations, including a dramatic trip to Belgium by Canada's Minister of Trade, Chrystia Freeland, the deal was signed last weekend by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. However, the future of the trade deal is not a foregone conclusion. Stuart True is the editor of The Monitor, which is published by the Canadian Centre of Policy Alternatives. He's also the co-editor with Scott Sinclair of the Trans-Pacific Partnership in Canada, a citizen's guide. He joins us on the phone from Ottawa. Hello, Stuart.
Hi, Esther.
Can you just briefly remind us what CETA is?
So CETA is what the government would call a next-generation free trade agreement. It's much like NAFTA, although it does go quite a bit further in terms of limiting government's policy space in areas like regulations, how governments regulate, what sectors, and in what ways. It goes much further than NAFTA in the protections it gives to investors when they want to invest in Canada from Europe or when Canadian investors want to invest there. And it goes much further in areas, new areas, like services and new areas like patent protection for medicines, copyright, this kind of thing. So it's quite a broad, it's a constitution-type document in a way that will put limits on governments in Europe and Canada in how they intervene in commerce or intervene in the market, if you will.
And how does the region of Wallonia different from the rest of Belgium, and how did their protest come about?
Well, the region, I think what you saw in Belgium was there's been, first of all, there's been a lot of opposition in Europe across the continent, actually, a lot of citizen opposition to both CETA with Canada and a sister agreement with the United States. And this has been building. At first kind of quietly, but now quite loudly for the past year. And so when you saw what the past few weeks we saw in Wallonia, we saw a government actually taking that resistance within its community to CETA and taking it seriously and using that to push for changes to the agreement in areas that they really felt they couldn't live with. They couldn't live with Europe and Canada signing the deal as is. And so some of the areas related to the investment protection chapter. So this is, of course, the process in CETA, as we have in NAFTA, that allows companies to sue governments when certain public interest measures, environmental policies, resource management decisions, that kind of thing, very broad spectrum of public policies. It lets companies sue governments when those interfere with their ambitions and interfere with their profits. And so Wallonia and actually three other regions in Belgium looked at this and said, we can't live with that. It's unnecessary in an agreement between two developed countries, such as Canada and the European Union, where our courts are totally sufficient for handling those kinds of disputes with companies. We want it out of the agreement. They also had problems with some of the chapters in CETA on regulation. So they had questions around how would the domestic regulation chapter, how would the chapters on technical barriers to trade and so forth, how would those affect the Wallonia government's sovereignty, its ability to set its own policies within Belgium. And so they were bolstered by the public opposition and decided to push back. And they were brave for doing that. I mean, they were one of the few governments in Europe who decided that they didn't like the deal and they'd like to push back. And it was actually quite remarkable to see. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation here, it did have an impact. It almost derailed the agreement. But, of course, they did come back round to some kind of compromise, and here we are now.
I understand that the region in Wallonia is it's more of a rural region with comprised of a lot of farmers. Is that one of the things that united them against this agreement?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Wallonia is there was many reasons why Wallonia might have felt more threatened by CETA than other regions. One is, yes, a very farming community. Also, an industrial community, or I should say a post-industrial community, where there are factories that are not running anymore. So it used to be a place where things were built, you know, steel, manufactured goods for the European market. And, of course, the era of globalization, companies consolidating their operations, moving things to areas where they can produce things cheaper. You know, the region actually suffered from that. So you do see quite a lot of opposition to these kinds of agreements that are designed to benefit companies that want to go offshore or consolidate and cut jobs, that kind of thing. So definitely that played into why Wallonia would have taken the stand it did.
And what should Canadians know about this agreement?
Well, one, I think they should realize that this government is in a big hurry to ratify it. So, I mean, this week, actually, just the day after they signed it in Brussels, the government introduced ratifying legislation, which, according to the NDP, is actually against the rules. They were supposed to wait 21 days before they introduced legislation to pass the agreement. In this case, I think they didn't. They're trying to rush it through so that it puts even more pressure on the European Parliament to pass it when it has to do the same process in December or January, whenever they get to it. I think, importantly, we need to realize that the costs of CETA in Canada far outweigh any benefits. The benefits will be go mainly to a few limited export sectors where there may be gains. So you think about there's some maybe gains for some seafood processors out in Atlantic Canada. There's maybe some agricultural gains, very small, though even the industry here, even the beef and pork industry is saying these are not huge gains for them. On the flip side, we are going to be extending patents on brand name drugs by about two and a half years, and that's going to permanently increase the cost of pharmaceutical products in Canada, which is going to hit us annually to the tune of about, we estimate, around $800 million. So this is a permanent, ongoing cost of the CETA agreement to Canada that is nowhere made up for in any of the so-called tariff savings we're going to see from eliminating tariffs. We're going to be guaranteed to see more NAFTA-like lawsuits against Canadian policies. So we just lost one a couple weeks ago related to a decision in Ontario to put a moratorium on wind farms on the Great Lakes. This would have been the first time in the world that wind farms were considered for a freshwater lake. The province stepped back from its decision to move ahead with that plan. It says it wants to think about it some more, and it put a moratorium on the process, and it was challenged under these investment protections in NAFTA and ended up having to pay the company about $28 million simply for changing its mind. I mean, this is absurd. And these are the kinds of cases we're going to see more and more of. And that's a permanent cost. Again, it's a cost to the public sector, the amount of money we spend in lawyers' fees, and then compensation to these companies that really we should not be compensating simply for the right to regulate their activity. We're going to see that go through the roof with CETA. So these are some of the permanent costs we have to consider in Canada about whether or not we want to move forward with the deal that is really going to have very minor trade benefits for a few Canadian sectors.
Now, I'm sure these are some of the concerns also that the people in Wallonia were having. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the compromise was that enabled the signing of the agreement?
Sure. This is a very interesting compromise. There, unfortunately, the Wallonian government is kind of backing away from its earlier very strong position. They're saying this is the new CETA, whatever they've come up with. That's not true at all. It's still the old CETA. They didn't get any change to the text of the agreement. What they did get, though, is a few conditions. So Belgium, for example, will ask the European Court of Justice whether or not CETA's investment court system, these are the protections we talked about and the right to sue, whether or not that violates European treaties and violates the autonomy of European member states and regional governments with the same status as Wallonia does. So that's going to move ahead, and that could potentially put a wrinkle into the ratification of CETA in Europe, depending on what the Court of Justice says next year. Wallonia also got the right to say no to CETA. If they're not satisfied with some of the reforms that Canada and the EU continue to work on with respect to this investment court system, then Wallonia can decide it will not ratify the agreement, and Belgium must make that known to the Commission, that Belgium cannot ratify as a result of these regions also not wanting to ratify. So that was an important step as well. The reality is, already in Europe, CETA is not guaranteed to be permanently ratified because there is other opposition in other countries. Austria, even Germany, is not guaranteed that every required government within Germany or every level of government will be able to support the deal. And so Amsterdam, just this week, they're, I think, two-thirds of the way toward gathering enough signatures to demand a referendum on ratifying CETA in the Netherlands, excuse me. So that could put an end to the agreement as well. As a result of the Wallonian resistance and a decision in Germany with Germany's constitutional court, we're at a point where CETA can be brought into place mostly, or they call it provisionally brought into place, within Europe and Canada as soon as the European Parliament and Canadian Parliament have voted on it. But at any point after that, if one of the member states in Europe says, no, we cannot ratify this agreement, the whole thing could fall apart entirely and the deal disappears. So I see that as a hopeful thing because there is really not a very good social or economic case for this agreement in Canada. So I would love to see that happen. But the point is, I think for the government here in Canada, it's far too soon to celebrate this as a victory because there's so many uncertainties coming down the road in Europe.
Can you talk about what's going on in Canada? Are there any cracks in moving forward with this deal?
There's not a lot, unfortunately. As I said, the government has introduced ratifying legislation at Parliament. Obviously, there will be debate in the House of Commons. It's unclear if the government will move to limit that debate. Hopefully, it doesn't. But then it will go to committee, and the committee will bring forward witnesses who will speak to the benefits or not of ratifying the deal. So that process will roll out over the next few weeks. And I think the government is probably hoping it can have a deal passed through Parliament before the end of the year, again, so that it can show its allies in the European Parliament that now the deal is in place on one side, you guys better get your act together and move forward. Provincially, in some provinces, we're going to have to see legislation introduced as well. It's unclear to me exactly which provinces will have to do that. Some of them might not, but there will be similar legislation to bring the agreement into play at the provincial level. That would be another place where you could see some pushback from environmental groups, labor unions here in Canada, groups like the Trade Justice Network, who have been fighting for years to try and stop this deal. There's going to be room for activism at that level as well. And I think, interestingly, at the municipal level, there are areas already in Canada a few years ago, starting in 2010, we started to see municipalities passing motions against the deal, a lot of them in BC, actually, including Victoria, who said, we don't want to be part of a deal that restricts our ability to prefer local bids when we put out public tenders. Of course, that's exactly what CETA does. There's also chapters that haven't really been sufficiently studied, I think, and one of them is on domestic regulations, which includes restrictions on how municipalities can approve or not, licensing requirements or qualifications requirements on certain projects, for example, mineral projects, pipelines, these kinds of things. There are new limits on the way governments approve, make those decisions that might very much impact municipal governments, including around zoning decisions or around fees that they put on application processes for any number of municipal projects. So I think there may be some need for municipalities like Victoria, Vancouver, and elsewhere go back and look at the agreement now that it's been signed and we can see the whole thing out in the open like that. So I think that's another area that could pose some problems. And, there are potentially, and I don't think this is a big potential, but in places like Newfoundland and Labrador, where they've agreed to get rid of minimum processing rules on fish caught in Canadian waters off the Atlantic coast, the government has promised compensation for those provinces, and they haven't quite figured out what that's going to look like yet. So it could be that some Atlantic provinces start to stir the pot if they feel that they're not being adequately compensated by Ottawa for the losses they could take to jobs, processing jobs in the eastern provinces.
Well, thank you very much, Stuart, for letting us know where the cracks are and how we can approach that, especially our listeners right here in Vancouver. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Esther.
I've been speaking with Stuart True. He's the editor of The Monitor, which is published by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. You can read his blog posts at policyalternatives.ca. His new book, The Trans-Pacific Partnership and Canada, co-edited with Scott Sinclair, has just been published.